Somebody in the narthex a couple weeks ago said to me, "What's the Bible? What's the whole point of the Bible?" My off-the-cuff answer was, perhaps not the best answer, but what it was, I said, "Well, it tells the story of our sad and pathetic attempts to try to get near God, and even worse, to pretend as though we are God. And it's God eye-rolling and ignoring us, and in fact choosing to come near to us, that we might have communion with God, and we might finally see God face to face." It doesn't take much of a trek through the Bible to actually see a lot of that. There's the great story of the conniver Jacob. He dreams, he sees a ladder letting down from heaven to earth, all the angels going back and forth, presumably delivering God's mail. Or even the strange story of the Israelites' escape from slavery in Egypt. While the escape itself is mentioned, the Bible goes to such great lengths, page after page after boring page, telling minute details about a tent, a portable tent, a tent of meeting that Israel would utilize in the desert in order to be met by and to meet God. And then the stories reach their culmination, in some sense, with the grand temple in Jerusalem that Solomon builds. In some sense, the center of the world. Mount Zion, where God condescends to his people and heaven and earth traffic with one another. It took 50 years to build, occupied almost 30 acres, a marvel of the ancient world. And Israel, when Israel would go up to pray, they would turn toward the temple, this place of divine human meeting. And it's the point when pilgrims would make the festival trek up to Jerusalem. It's not merely they're going to the capital city, not merely they're going to the temple. I mean, they are going to heaven, right? They're going to meet God and be met by God. The prophet Isaiah foretold a day when not just Israel, but all the nations would stream up to the temple and they would sing, "Let us go to Jerusalem. Let us go to the temple where we can learn the ways of God and we can walk with God." Everybody would gather to worship the true God at the temple, a house of prayer for all people, is how St. Matthew puts it. Then in John's gospel, which we catch a little bit of this morning, John goes on to say that Jesus, in some sense, is now a new temple, a new means of mediation between God and humankind. And really, after that Easter morning, after the tomb was empty, after the disciples behold what had happened, they came to believe that the meeting place between God and humanity was now to be found in the man from Nazareth, in the itinerant rabbi, on the one they had crucified. The gospel reading takes place a few days earlier. Jesus has gathered with his disciples. He's in the upper room sharing a last meal with them, sharing the Passover meal with them. But Jesus calls the Passover bread his body, and he urged his disciples to feed on him. He passed around a cup of wine, telling them that the wine was now, in some sense, the sacrificial blood poured out like the blood that's dashed upon the altar on the temple. So John imagines that while the temples where Israel celebrated the covenant between God and Israel, now this cup, now this bread, was a sign that of the new covenant God was ratifying not just with Israel, but the whole world. Now the necessary ladder from heaven to earth and back again, the movable tent of meeting, the great high altar, all sort of embodied in Jesus. He has come into the world. Now the appointed means to enable us to get to God, and God to get what was provided in Jesus, God's own Son. The work that God did on the cross on Good Friday was in fact redemptive because it brought God close to us, which was done now for all time, all places, and all people. So things are winding down. He's having a meal with his disciples, with his friends, an intimate gathering to show forth a God who chooses and wants to be intimate with us, God with us at the table, There is the temple, his body. There we partake of his body. There is salvation for all. We meet God in bread and wine. But how will the story end? Where does the story go? Shall we see face to face God? Our second lesson this morning is from the book of Revelation. One of the last chapters of the book of Revelation, in the last book, John the seer, he imagines. He dreams of what it's like to see God finally face to face. And he writes, "Behold, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them and they will be his people. God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear away from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the former things have passed away." That's his vision, together with a vision of the holy city of Jerusalem, the home of God among mortals. And then we get all this detail. An angel takes John up the high mountain, and he looks out there. He's in some kind of weird trance. He has a dream of the city descending out of the clouds, and it's quite a dream. It is the dream of the final culmination of all things, of the interaction between us and God, the meeting between us and God in the flesh, face to face. He fed us with his body. Now John imagines a day when we will behold him as the Lamb upon the throne. We shall see him face to face. He imagines this new city, this city set on the hill, where the distance between us and God is finally overcome. Not by anything that we did, by the sheer wonderful act of the Lamb upon the throne, coming home to be with us. As John imagined it, there's no churches, there's no temples, there's in the great city. Why? Because God will be all in all. Amazingly, there's no streetlights, no police searchlights, no sun, no moon. Why? Because there'll be just the light of the glory of God. No polluted streams, no mercury-saturated lakes, no acid rain in the city of God, just one pure crystal river, as John puts it. No hospitals in the city of God, no mental health clinics, and nobody's on chemotherapy. The healing of God flourishes and shimmers like leaves on a tree. Right? Is that simply sort of a pie in the sky, kind of an unrealistic vision? Right? It's awfully weird. But I don't think so. In fact, I'm sort of absolutely persuaded that we cannot now live responsible, faithful, ethical lives here in the present unless God has given us a clear glimpse, a compelling vision of where this story is going. Why? Because the Christian life is too demanding. It's too difficult. Christ's way of the cross is too hard. How do you keep at it? Again, I think you can only keep at it if you have some sense of the ultimate final destination, if you've got some sense of the last chapter of the story. And here we've come to nearly the last chapter, the climactic ending. This speaks of a time when the new Jerusalem descends and God says, "It's done." What began in Genesis 1, the Lamb on the throne now brings to completion. This grand vision is where the Lamb says, "I am the Alpha, I am the Omega, I am the beginning, I am the end." Right? That is, we believe we worship one who not only creates, not only generates, but the one who stands at the end, who brings all things to completion. That's good news, to behold the vision of the end, because that means that our death is not the end. Rather, we believe, starting at Easter and brought to completion at the end, that death is overcome. Death has been vanquished. The foe has been defeated, has left the field. Again, it's not a poetic, pie-in-the-sky kind of dreaming, though it sure feels like it. But rather, it's a promise, right? The Minneapolis Youth Chorus will sing in a little bit, "The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord look upon you with favor and give you peace." It's a promise. And John the seer imagined what happens when that promise comes true. When the Lord has blessed you, right? When the Lord now keeps you. When you now see the Lord's face shining upon you. It's like God promising, this is what I'm doing to repair the mess that we've made of things. This is how we're going to bring everything to its end. And sometimes some of us, we catch glimpses of what that means. And it helps us live today. In her book, Amazing Grace, Kathleen Norris tells a story about her friend. Her friend's a Benedictine nun. And the friend was by her own mother, trying to give her some comfort as she lay there dying. She said, "Think, Mama, you are about to enter heaven and everybody will love you there. Everybody you love will be there, sorry." And her mom rose up from the pillow and said, No, it's not that everybody I love will be there. It's that I will love everybody who's there." Right? She sort of catches a glimmer of what the end looks like. And it changes then today. God is coming down. God is restoring creation. God is coming to us, first in bread and wine, finally in completion, face to face. And that hope, that final hope, that transformative hope, makes a difference now. When we catch a glimpse of what this means, it changes us, how we live, and makes all the difference until the end. Thanks be to God. Amen.